How do you deal with these questions about the will? If we are not in control of our will, how much of our actions in life are we able to control? It's all of them. It is because that's how it appears to you. And your appearances is your reality. However, the truth of the matter is something different. So, when you actually penetrate to see yourself, really see it, only then you realize just how this process works. And you also realize you can be free of karma. Why do you think that when you become a stream winner, then all that kind of karma, which would suit, usually seem to blow up, is totally abolished, wiped out? You let it go. Because you realize, and you see totally, not just as an idea or theory, as truth by the nose in front of your face, it means that it's not lost. That's why you let it go. That's why stream winners can never go to our minds. However, until we see this, basically, if we own our will, then it looks like we are controlling things. How much people would have said that I'm at all? Well, Professor Lippitt, he was not a Buddhist, but just a psychologist, he made a very interesting point. He said there is no such thing as free will. But there is free won't. Not I will, but I won't. The ability to stop, to renounce, to let go. He said, now that is nothing you can actually see in his experiments. It's a very interesting idea that things which we do don't come from us, but the ability to stop, to restrain, to let go, that is very much in our power. To stop, to restrain. So that's how there's a little bit of control of non-doing. If so, it's just under the illusion that things happen out of our planning and effort. Yeah, of course. When you see that, it's really nice because if things go well, I know it's not my planning, my effort, I'm not responsible. If people come up and say, oh, great, it's all, yeah, thank you very much. So I receive the praise. If they blame me, it's a terrible retreat, that's really disorganized. Not my fault. So I have a choice. I was seeing my advice. The plan goes to something else. How can we be sure that actions are aligned with Dharma when we don't really have control? By attending Buddhist centers, by brainwashing yourself, reading books, meditating, and then you find that your actions of body, speech, and mind are in accordance with the Dharma. Allow yourself to be brainwashed. Anyway, how old can little children start meditation? Can we teach them just to focus on their breathing in and out? The earliest kid, which I knew did meditation, was only about 3 or 4 days old. His mother told me this story. She was there in hospital, giving birth to the baby in hospital. Oh, everything going well. She just finished breastfeeding her baby, so she was lying back on the hospital bed, just finished breastfeeding the baby, and then the baby crawled up to her tummy by itself, sat up, crossed its legs with 4 lotuses, put the right hand over the left hand, and freed the mother out. It was actually meditating. Where did I learn that from? Maybe he learned it from the mother. Now, why it was in the womb? Or more likely, from a previous life. Just finished eating, felt good, now it's time to eat. And that was an amazing thing. But most babies, or most kids, are sometimes 6 or 7 or 8, but teach them how to neutralize. Because, I told this recently, that it was here or in birth, when I first went to birth, Ajahn Chakra was the abbot, and so he gave me all the other jobs, like teaching the grammar school, teaching the brats, I mean the kids.
people.
So anyway, not for another part of the world. So, these individual kids, you know, 5 or 6 year olds. So there I had a half dozen of them in the little hall, had to teach them meditation. What can they do? So they were reasonably compliant. So I told them, okay, close your eyes, get yourself out of cover, like I told you. And now, I know one thing about kids, they're very good visualizing and imagining. Now imagine you're in your body, and now you're flying out of your body, up and away, through the roof of this temple, over the suburbs to the beach, to the ocean. Because kids in Australia love the ocean, love the beach. And if you're over the beach, to the ocean, to your special place in the ocean, and you drop gently down, and there you are, floating in the warm, comfortable ocean, so peaceful, so warm. You look around, you can't see anybody else because this is your private place in the ocean, perfectly safe. You can't see any animals, no fish, you can't see any ships. All you can see is beautiful ocean, peaceful. And you look up into the sky and it's warm and blue, and a few little clouds floating over the ocean. And you can hear a few birds flying in the distance, but so calm and peaceful. And you're just lying there on floating without a care in the world, nothing to do. Beautiful, warm, comfortable, your place in the middle of the ocean. When I started teaching them, I started really getting off on this one. And then when it's time to come out, imagine yourself, time to come home again now. So imagine yourself saying goodbye to the private piece of the ocean. Floating up and up and up, all the waves over the ocean. You can see the beach in the distance, and you go closer and closer, over the beach, over the suburbs, through the roof of the temple, back into your body. Now look nice. They did that. The weird thing was that these people, they still come around and say, oh, well, they're 40 now. And they tell me, you know, I still do that meditation. Other meditations don't work for me. And of course, that's what I taught, but just make out something wrong, it works. So just see what you can do. But don't try and teach a 7-year-old how to count. It has to be visualized something which is at their level of cognition. Yeah, okay, how to balance play life and spiritual life? It's like coming to retreats when you've got a few days off. And then, this is what my teacher said. I did mention this to Victor at the fundraising dinner, but I didn't say it totally. Because when Ajahn Chah was still alive, started getting famous, and was still teaching, so there was a man, a gentleman from Sydney, he came and told me the story himself, that he heard of this great master, Ajahn Chah. And he always had these questions he'd like to ask somebody. You know, deep questions about life. And he thought this smart Ajahn Chah might be able to answer these questions. So he flew all the way from Sydney to Bangkok. From Bangkok up to the town of Ubud. From Ubud he got a taxi to walk up home where Ajahn Chah lived. Out of the taxi he had to walk about a kilometre to where Ajahn Chah's hut was. He came all that way just for one thing. To ask the questions of Ajahn Chah. And when he got to the place where Ajahn Chah was at the Peter's side, there were a couple of hundred people surrounding him, all asking their questions, not just getting blessings and criticizing what else. And fortunately, Ajahn Chah never signed books. So anyway, he was waiting and waiting and waiting, an hour, 2 hours went past, and he was nowhere near to Ajahn Chah. And he realized he had to get his taxi, so he took out back to the airport to fly back to Sydney. He realized there's no way he can ask his questions of such a famous monk. So very disappointed, he got up to leave. And when he looked at his watch, he realized he had to travel another hour before his taxi would pick him up to take him back to the airport. Get him out of here. So he looked and saw the gnats were sweeping the grounds of the monastery. And he thought, well, why don't I do something good? At least there is a good karma around here. And I'm disappointed not being able to see the teacher. So he picked up a broom and started sweeping. It must have been something about the ability, the willingness to do some good karma by sweeping. Because as he was sweeping, after 10 or 15 minutes, he felt a hand on his shoulder. And he looked around and was Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah, really good master, so calm and compassionate, he'd obviously seen this Westerner waiting at the edge, not having a chance to ask any questions. So Ajahn Chah came to see him, especially when he saw him popping up, doing some sweeping. But unfortunately, Ajahn Chah didn't have much time. So he just gave him a very quick teaching. Now I teach for hours and hours and hours and hours and more than I'm supposed to be. Ajahn Chah says one sentence, and wow! Wish I could do that. And what Ajahn Chah said was, if you are going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then Ajahn Chah left. Now this was coming from a great master. So it didn't mean just a sweep harder. Put some effort into it, get a sweat out with a lazy bum. That's not what he meant. But he thought about that, he was on the trip home in the aircraft. And he realized what he meant. The understanding he got was totally accurate. If you're sweeping, total mindfulness, that's the most important thing in the world, give the sweeping everything you've got. When it's time to rest at night time, lay in the bed, give rest everything you've got. You need to put your efforts, skill, whatever it takes, to have a good rest of night. Don't work while you're in bed. When you get up in the morning and you go to work, keep work everything you've got. When you're with your family, keep your family everything you've got. When you're out relaxing, playing, enjoying yourself, keep that enjoyment everything you've got. When you're meditating, keep meditating everything you've got. And he said that was his understanding. And he said he went back to Sydney. And his career took off. He became extremely wealthy, great family, very good meditation too. Because when he was meditating, he wasn't thinking of his work or his family. Right there with the meditation. When he was at the desk working, he didn't think of his family. Right there working. In this moment, everything he got. That's why he became very successful. And that's a great way of how to balance your spiritual life and your worldly life. If you're in the temple, doing spiritual things, give that everything you've got. If you're meditating, you're not that thing about when you leave in a couple of days' time, meditation is everything you've got. What is eating? Don't talk about meditating. You're very good at that, you're eating everything you've got. But you focused on eggs. So that's a very important teaching I think this time. But I didn't mention that on my fundraiser. And I mentioned that to you before you go on Sunday, there's two donation box over there. So what do you keep donations? Give it everything you've got. It doesn't work, does it? It's a good life. Give everything you've got. If in the beginning I can't find the breath, can I use other objects of meditation, e.g. tense thoughts, and etc., or even just watch the quietness? That is understanding. Watching the quietness is the best, but if you can't find the thought, don't be concerned about that. Remember what I've said twice already. Now is the most important time. There is no other time. The object in front of you is the most important meditation object in the world. So, you can't find the breath, but what's right in front of you now? What is it? You're aware of. Right now. And so is that. It's such an easy thing to do because you don't need to search for it. It's already here. Whatever that is. And care for it. Don't try and get rid of it. Don't try and cure it. Don't try and get hold of it. Just care for it. So that is beautiful. away from imitating. Also remember that the object in front of you, on your arm, or level right now, is your meditation. It's the best object in the whole world. Not a bed, not images, where you can serve right now. You just care. That really takes off. As a Buddhist who has taken the five precepts, should be I be offering vegetarian food as Dharma Tell how to Sangha? Why is meat still being offered? It's being offered to me here. Because I was telling people that I tried meat sometimes. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. And had a lot of control over what I ate because I was so nervous. Then he went to Thailand and he had to eat pork or rice. Buffalo afterbirds, insects, snails, gross stuff. But he had to do that because that's all there was there. And now I was actually quite healthy for the 8-9 years I was in Thailand. When I went back to Australia, that's when my tummy started getting worse and worse and worse. And started getting headaches, feeling nauseous, and then I decided to go back to eating the food which I ate when I grew up. The Western food, English food. And as soon as I did that, I started getting healthy again. I often wonder why is that. It's because this is the food I grew up with. This is the food my tummy learned how to digest. In all those years, it's what conditioned my digestive system. And you know, the food I eat, you wouldn't be able to digest because you weren't born and bred in London. For me, this is food my tummy recognizes this. It's fed, I don't digest it, and it goes really easily. When I don't do that, I get sick. Even the first day I was sick. Normally, the first day, I had a tummy ache, and very light diarrhea, just very, very loose rounds. I never told anybody, because if I tell anybody, everyone would have all this medicine in front of me. You go in this, you go and eat that. I tried very hard for many years just to withdraw, but one of the things which really tipped me over to say, no, I won't come from my diet. It's when I gave a talk in Jakarta, Bhutan, many, many years ago. Many of you may have seen me. I was giving a talk, and I said, no more questions, I've got to go. And I never made it. I vomited in public. About 1,000 people saw that. It was such a wonderful thing I did. Now anybody saw me, I'm not making this up. Sometimes I do get sick. So that's why I have to be careful of the diet. So there's many other monks like that as well. So you just ask them to see, you know, what type of food. Don't let the monks be picky and say, I want this type of sausage and made from this place, this length, this width. Don't be picky, but just saying, you know, the type of food they like, the low fat, or oily, or salty, or whatever. So we get back to be healthy, don't we? So sometimes some monks can be vegetarian. Younger ones today, most of the young people do become vegetarian, but because they grow up on that. But it's a sense of conditioning that the old guys like me, it's very difficult. I'd love to be. But you know, I'm just not get sick and I'll be throwing up and be eating talks. There we go. So yes, please. The Buddha ate meat, so it's okay to offer meat to a Sangha member. The Tibetans also eat meat. And even some of my Mahayana monks eat meat. Whenever I go to Kuru here, yeah, because I have problems there as well, the monks there know that I usually have some meat. And the monk who's using my attendant, I have a monk's attendant, he loves it when I help. Because he can eat some meat as well. He usually has to be vegetarian because he's a Mahayana man. He said, I don't know, this is like Christmas. Oh, poor luck. But he tried this. Imagine how important for Buddhists to be a vegetarian on a vegetarian question. As much as you possibly can. But don't criticize other people like me who have to eat some meat. So, don't criticize others. When I was a vegetarian, don't be like this. I was invited to have dinner with my girlfriend. So, this is before I was a monk. Just making clear. in the evening, dressing up, and she made me meat. It was like a meat curry. Brown rice and meat curry vegetables. And I said, I'm a vegetarian. You should know that. I am not eating that. And that was the end of our relationship. She was really fed up with me. She went to so much trouble cooking that for me. I don't know how many hours of going shopping, picking out a recipe, making it all nice, you know, for my boyfriend. And I would have to do it on that time. And I really feel bad about that. To this day, that was not a good thing to do. I really disappointed her. I hurt her. And what I should have done, if I was back there, I would have eaten that curry with the meeting, even though I was vegetarian. And thank you very much, darling. It's really nice. The next time, remember, I'm vegetarian. In a nice way. You're so unconscious, that doesn't matter. Because I should be kind to people. So don't be so critical to those people who want to use love compliments. And anyway, here come the jokes. Just as people really start being cheeky at me and criticizing me for eating meat, I said, listen, have you never heard the saying, you are what you eat? You heard that before? So if you eat vegetables, you become a vegetarian. And then, don't be joking, and then, the making even worse, the people really upset me about this one. Because how, this is the question, how can a vegetarian eat a steak, a beef steak? How can they do that? It's very easy. You take a cow, compassionately under anesthetic, you give the cow a medical procedure called a lobotomy. Now when the cow comes out of anesthetic, having taken parts of its brain out, the cow is a vegetable. Vegetables. Don't be a child, nice story, make the chance for the second. That's how it's really this guy looks terrible, but I'm so responsible for that. I never get that idea to that one. Then I jump around. How to explain it during meditation. I notice my member moving up and down, his hands above the body, and so he trusts, but he couldn't move back in position after a few minutes of trust. So his hands up. It's sometimes you see those things happen to people's very, very rare. And you just ask, are you really being mindful? Are you really aware? Are you half asleep? And in the end, are you really aware of mindfulness? This tend not to happen. Except, in very rare cases, when there's a movement like that, you're perfectly aware of the knowledge of your body inside. And all that really is your body healing itself. Haven't mentioned this yet, but the case which I always bring up was of a woman many years ago in one of my meditation retreats, who when she was meditating turned around and would contort her body so much that I could not even show you that. If I contorted like she did, you'd have to take me to hospital. And somebody else, you know, pointed that out to me, have a look at her, look at how she's sitting. She was all over the place. And no, really sort of something, I thought she was really being injured afterwards. And so I waited for her to come out of the meditation, took her aside, and said, how do you feel? She said, marvelous, great. And I said, when you were meditating, you were twisted all around, so much so that you must be hurt. I don't hurt at all, so I'm really twisted around. And then, sort of, as I say, the petty clock, the light bulb gets up. Ah, I said, where did you have your car accident? She looked at me, how did you know? I always thought you had psychic powers. Now it's confirmed. I told you. I said, no, it's not psychic powers, it's understanding of meditation. because you have got a very bad car accident, she was lucky to come out alive, many months in hospital, recovering. So you injured your body really badly. The doctors could do so much, hospital treatment, physiotherapy could do so much. But now your body realizes it's got a twist like that to open up the channels of energy to heal this one. Now, no one else can do that because no one else has been that type of car crash. In your body, there is exactly what to do. So be happy. And from that time on, you have seen many people like that. Leaning forward or leaning this way, or the body moving up. All it is the body healing itself. And the other thing, like somebody asked me during the interviews, sometimes part of your body gets really hot. The hot spots. So usually in the neck somewhere, girls in their breasts, guys in their knees or something, there's one part that's really hot. What on earth is going on? It's healing. Your body, when you let go of it, you start controlling it, it starts to vanish. A lot of times you don't feel it, it's afterwards. When you start to vanish and start controlling your body, the body has the opportunity to heal itself. When you're too aware, you get in the way. You feel these hot spots in the brain. Afterwards, it feels so relaxed and so wonderful. That's all it is. The body knows there's a problem somewhere, sends all the energy to that area, that's why it feels hot. And afterwards, it feels so relaxed. So, many women have had hot spots in their breasts and they're meditating. Well done. You have just avoided the breast cancer. Body's got there before the cancer was even noticed by the scans. So if that ever happens, it's one of those problems we can have to deal with. The body heals itself. It knows what to do. Give it a chance. Hot spots, signs of what it's healing. So that's what happens when people move or have hot spots. Is it true that we can't be a screamer unless we become a monk or live as a yogi in retreat center? Well, there is a loophole. If you give a donation big enough and we can absolve it, no, we don't have corruption in the Dhamma. Other places, yes. So, of course you can become a screenwinner as a lay person. You don't have to become a monk or a nun. Or live as a yogi in the retreat center. You can't be a screenwinner. Screenwinners at the time of the Buddha were lay people. Even screenwinners, not screenwinners, even non-returners. There's just one step less than being fully enlightened. They were lay people. But to describe what a non-returner would look like. So you can recognize it because there's all sorts of people, especially not so much in Malaysia or Singapore, but in the United States, there's so many of these crazy people go on a website claiming to be fully enlightened, powerhouse, enlightened ones, absolute scam artists. But people believe in it. So how can you check out if a person really is enlightened, or at least a non-returner? This is the standard. This fellow called Gatikara in the time of the Buddha. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. Gatikara was a non-returner. His first stage of enlightenment was still a lay person, a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha. And the only reason why he didn't renounce and become a monk was because he had two elderly parents who were both blind. He had to look after his mom and dad. It's really important you do your family duties. But he could not go forth because he had to look after his mom and dad. But how did he look after them? He didn't have a wife or family, but what he did have was the skill of being a potter. So, he would not even dig the earth because he was afraid his spade might destroy a worm or a beetle. He would wait till rats would dig their holes, or the farmers would make their dikes in the paddy fields, and asked for some of that clay. And from that he made his pots. And he would never sell his pots. I always like to say this because even monks sometimes get too much into business. Shows they're not even very close to being enlightened. This was a non-return. How did he manage to survive? He made his pots, put them on a bench, put a sign up, anyone wants a pot, please pay them up to free. No charge. If anyone wants to leave some rice and lentils to feed me and my parents, you can leave them over here. He was barter, but with no sort of so much for this, so much for that. He was so unworldly, he wouldn't sell anything. If you want a pot, take one. And out of gratitude, people would leave rice and lentils so he could make some food for his parents. That was the art. That's it, the non-return in the time castle of the Buddha. That's how unworldly they are. So if you see someone saying they're enlightened, driving around in a Rolls Royce car, wearing Armani suits, with Rolex watches, you know that they cannot be enlightened. It just doesn't fit at all. And with that Gatikara Sutta, I already mentioned in passing, in that sutta, Gatikara's best friend was Jodhimana. And Jodhimana was not religious at all. Gatikara, being a non-returner, a very cheap disciple of the Buddha Kassapa, the previous Buddha, kept on saying, come and see the Buddha, come and see him. You might learn something. I am not interested in all that rubbish. He actually scolded the Buddha as a shaving-headed loser. Good for nothing. And eventually, Gatikara managed to trick his best friend to come and see the Buddha Kassapa. And Jodhimana saw the Buddha for the first time, quite inspired, apologized for scolding or saying rude things about Buddha Kassapa, and Jodhimana became a monk. And in the next life, Jodhimana was born as Siddhartha Gautama and became a Buddha. Which is why that Siddhartha Bodhi, Gatikara, who was the non-returner, stood around with a pure nose, came down to say, well done, friend. We were in the same village before. We were mates, sisters mates, in our previous life. After the non-returner, he became a Buddha, Sadhusana, son of the world. Two friends, congratulating each other. It's a very beautiful sutta. It shows what a Buddha would be like in a previous life. Wouldn't even recognize the Buddha until it was actually was put right in front of him. Very fascinating story. Anyway, how would one discover that they've been enlightened? What happens when enlightenment occurs? Enlightenment is such a great powerful word in Buddhism, but what does it actually mean to become enlightened? What it means to become enlightened? Fully enlightened means you've got no more craving, no more wants, can't get angry. That's why when I became enlightened, am I told the story? When I got angry because this stupid, greedy monk, hypocrite, poor, the lovely poor curry, the wrong fish curry, after taking his own out first. And I realized, I'm not enlightened. Enough people do not get angry. And in fact, that's usually, I've said it before, that's usually the trick which we use to test. If you come up to me and say you're fully enlightened, I abuse you. I say, you? No way could a woman become enlightened these days. And I see your reaction. What do you mean? You mean you're as good as men? What are you talking about? I've tried anything to make you angry. Pushing every button I know to see if you can upset. And if you do, well, sorry, fell to test. Was that lovely story? There was make one of the kids, no, no, wait, this is a good yarn. Okay, no. This, says Dickens later on, there was a monk, a Chinese monk, a long time ago, told his abbot, I really want to go through enlightenment in this life. And he said, not far from here is an island in the middle of the lake. No one is there. Can I build a little hut in there, a little garden? And I will meditate there alone. And all I would ask is for the tender to come over, to roam over to the island in the middle of the lake once a week for supplies. And I will give him a little note of what I want for next week so he can bring it next week. And that way I can live in perfect solitude. And the old rabbit said, no, why not? Give it a try. So he went over to the island, built himself a very simple hut, a little veggie match, and once a week, the attendant would roam over the boat and see if he needed any supplies, some rice, or some oil for his lamp, or any, you know, things like that, simple stuff. And after 3 years of meditating, this young man thought he'd cracked it. He was enlightened. Another arahant. So he thought, what should I do now? How can I tell the abbot? So next time the attendant came, he asked the attendant next week, please bring over some ink and a brush pen and some parchment. He wanted to write some calligraphy. So 1 week later, the attendant brought the items over, and the newly enlightened monk sat down in his hut and meditated very deeply for about 4 hours. When he came out of his meditation, his mind clear, he unrolled the scroll, dipped the brush in the ink, and wrote this exquisite calligraphy. You have to be so peaceful and so still to write to such a high standard. And what he wrote was a poem in 4 lines. And it translated as, the diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. In Buddhism, that means you're fully enlightened. No longer moved by worldly things, by the 4 worldly winds. And he let the parchment dry, rolled it up, and when the attendant ran over, he gave to the attendant the instructions, hand this over to the abbot personally, for me. When the attendant ran over, he was trying to think of what would happen when the abbot read this exquisite calligraphy, and how he would be so pleased that his disciple was now fully enlightened. So 1 week later, when the attendant came back, the attendant had another scroll for this monk from the abbot himself. And he opened it to try and find out the abbot's response to his claim to be enlightened. And he noticed it was his own scroll, the same scroll he sent over the last week. But he was mortified over the first line of his exquisite calligraphy. The abbot had written in a ballpoint pen in red ink, fart, F-A-R-T. And the second line, another fart, this time in capitals, capital F-A-R-T. And over the third line, the priceless, this is an arahant expressing his enlightenment in beautiful calligraphy, this is in the museum. This abbot is just desecrating it. The third line, F-A-R-T, capital letters underlined. And the fourth line, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. Another huge F-A-R-T, underlined three titles, exclamation marks. And the young man was so upset, so angry, irate. That stupid abbot, he hasn't got a clue what enlightenment is. And he's ruined. Really? My beautiful calligraphy! So he ran out and he caught the attendant before he was too far away from the shore, called him back, and demand to be taken to see that stupid old abbot. So the attendant rode him over to the monastery, the monk charged into the monk, the abbot's room, slammed the piece of parchment on the table and said, "It's three!" Very calmly, the abbot stood up, unfurled the scroll, and read it out. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet four little farts have blown in clean across the head. And the monk, so he came back and stayed in that hermitage for many, many, many more years. Never made that sad mistake again. This is what we do on purpose. We try and upset people. See, you get upset. If you do, sorry, carry on mentioning. That's how you know. People upset you, then you're in trouble. Second one, what is cemetery meditation and its benefits? Yes, first of all, the best way to do cemetery meditation is to die first. Or even better, when you're still alive, go to a cemetery and love by yourself. On the night when all of the souls come out from the ground, seeking to have your merits. Can you do that? At midnight, go to a cemetery. Stay there. So, but the real cemetery meditation is watching the decay of a human body, so you know it's not really nothing there. Just bones and blood and skin. So in the old days, cemeteries, they just toss the bodies in the cemetery, and the bodies will decay. So this is just a body, that's all. Nothing to really be proud of, or to be worried about, to the past Sunday anyway. So the cemetery meditation knows that it's very easy. Monks will go to the cemetery and watch the body decompose. And they realize that our bodies are the same, which means you lose attachment to your bodies. And especially you lose attachment to other people's bodies. Men don't get attached to women's bodies, you don't go, "Oh, she's us." No, it's just skin and bones, that's all. You don't, "That guy's hot." No, they're just guys, that's all. So that's one of the things with cemetery meditation. It actually helps to actually to let go of your attachment to the body. That's best actually, if you want some peace and quiet. Because when I was on this wandering, I'd ask that question, "Where can I go to get some peace and quiet?" And people always bothering you. Cemeteries. But in the cemetery, you go there at night time, and no police will follow you. You have a peaceful night. So I love the cemeteries. They're really good. But it's so rare. It's almost impossible these days to find ghosts. But, do you want to hear a ghost story? Okay, let's have the lights down, please. first of all, I want to see a show of hands. That's one of my old, now you probably all know this story, yeah, the coffin ghost. How many of you know the coffin ghost story? We had a majority of you know. Amazing. Okay, here we go. It's a scary one. Lights, give us some lights down. It's a light. Okay. That's good. And back, please. The lights just over there. Just over there behind the glass. Yeah, good. That's good. Oh, that's good. Yeah. Okay. Not far from my temple, a man came to listen to the Friday night talk. After the talk was over, he had to walk home. Now the usual way was along the streets, but there was a shortcut. And the shortcut was through the cemetery. And he was afraid of ghosts. They weren't going to do anything anyway. So he decided to walk through the cemetery. Take the shortcut. And if you walk through the cemetery at night time, especially when it's a wind, it can be a bit creepy. Especially along the streets, there are many street lamps. And in this cemetery, very few. And he got to the halfway mark. Everything was going well. No problem at all. But just past the halfway mark, you may have had this experience yourself. You feel that something is following you. You feel that. You couldn't hear anything at first, you could feel it. So he started walking a little bit faster. And as he started walking a little bit faster, whatever it was, also increased his speed. So he started walking really fast. And he started hearing coming behind him really fast. And that's when he made a big mistake. He turned around to look. And what he saw scared him to the marrow of his bones. What he saw following him was a coffin. A vertical coffin. Straight out of the grave. Still dirt falling off it. Bits of grass. The forest had come out of the grave. And it was following him. Bump. 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 That is scary. That is spooky. So he started running. Ran as fast as he could. But as he was running, bump, 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 the coffin started coming after him. He got out of the cemetery gate, turned left to go to his home, only a couple hundred yards away, and the coffin came out of the cemetery too, and started following him, bump, 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 chasing him down the road. He managed to get to the gate of his house. He never opened the gate. He jumped over it. As the coffin came faster after him, bump, 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 was catching up on him. He managed to get to the front door of his house. The missus was calling for the keys. He pulled out the keys. He dropped them on the ground. As the coffin came to the front gate, bump, 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 as the coffin started to pull that, push down the garden gate, and he leant down to pick up the keys, just as BAH! As the coffin broke the gate and came half in on the path, up, up, up. He picked up the first key, he could see, put it in the door, home for the best.
So lucky.
It was a white key. He turned the lock, opened the door, jumped inside, and slammed the front door of his house, just as the coffin, BAH! Came to the front door. He could see on the other side of the glass. His house. But he was home. He was safe. And he was sweating and panting. He never believed that something so supernatural could happen. Being chased by a coffin. As a coffin started to hit the door. As the heathen started to splinter. The door was going to give way. So he ran up the stairs to the second story. There's only one other room which had a lock on it, the bathroom. So he ran into the bathroom and locked the door, just as the coffin broke down the front door. And you could see the coffin at the bottom of the stairs, but even worse, the coffin could see him. Bump, bump, bump. As a coffin climbed the stairs. Bop, 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 as it got to the top landing. And he was in the bathroom with the door closed, but if that coffin could break down the strongest door in the house, the front door, what hope would he have that a simple bathroom door could withstand the strength of a supernatural coffin? He was scared out of his wits. as a coffin hit the bathroom door. As the bathroom door started to give way. As the bathroom door shattered. There was nothing now between him and that coffin. Nowhere to run. And so the coffin came towards him. Pop, pop. Instinctively, intuitively, without even thinking, he reached for something on the shelf in the bathroom to throw at the coffin. It was a bottle of medicine. The bottle broke over the coffin, and all this brown liquid spilled over the coffin, and the coffin stopped, never moved again. Because in that bottle was cough medicine. It stopped the coffin. That's what a father says, isn't it? Stop the coffin. Okay, that's the right thing. Kids love that joke. Even new kids. And I love it. Anyway, not necessarily keep that attention. Not really, but nevertheless. Is there any relationship or interactive, any relationship or interaction with meditation and knowledge of the Abhidhamma? No, not at all. Again, the Abhidhamma was not taught by the Buddha. It came out after the time of the Buddha. In the Buddha's time, there was no Abhidhamma in the way we have it these days. Abhidhamma in the time of the Buddha is only mentioned twice in the suttas. Not mentioned, meaning the books which we have now. What it was meant, it was always with Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. It means like deeper teachings of the training, like sense restraint. Deeper teachings of the Dhamma, like we hear here. The normal book, no systemized teaching. What you hear as in Abhidhamma is totally different. One from the top. Then Ajahn, when a person is in deep meditation, is there a way to get him or her out of meditation? Especially in emergency situations. Not really. Sometimes if they're not too deep in the jhana, you can talk to them because it's the sound which will take you out. So sometimes that's what you can do, just throw in there, you come on, time to go now. And you hear it like thousands of miles away, but that might just take you out. If that's not the case, then all you need to do is pick them up. Pick them up and carry them out, and then the car's taken away. They come out later. That's what happens. So they can't feel anything. So people still look people. They're perfectly safe. So in emergency situations, they're very, very happy. You can't even see mirrors yet, so why worry about you in the A poor mirror, my tears keep on coming out. How to deal with it? Very easy. Stop eating so much. When you dehydrate, you stop. This is doing so much, you get to a certain level, it overflows. Now, it's not by itself after a while, it's just joy and happiness coming out and so on. It's a nice thing to do, it's really healthy for you. So, just keep crying, keep on crying. After a while, it's not by itself. Yeah, what is the right view of cancer? Is it a disease or a natural process? Of adaption and therefore evolution which evolved mankind into being. Shall we just have the process of evolving mankind into evolving? It's done the last of a lot of times a stress result. Not every cancer comes from stress, sometimes it's because of some toxins which we're exposed to in the environment, like asbestos and other stuff. You get all sorts of nasty diseases. But a lot of it is stress related. Even if a person is exposed to toxins, some people develop cancer, some people don't. Why? Again, it's one's attitude and the peace, the strength of the immune system, which is increased by things like meditation. So it is a disease, because a disease is not right to eat anymore. So cancers do harm you. They kill you. But, you know, they seem to, because most cancers are stress-related, they do seem to respond to things like meditation. In a wonderful way. So please, check out the meditation if you have cancers. They really work. I remember listening to one of the meditation methods through chanting, instead of breathing method. It was a two or three syllables, simple chant from Eden Meeting. I was saying, can you tell us a little bit about it? Yeah, it is. Sometimes it's called substitution. If you really dig, you can't stop. And instead of the thought, you put something in its place, which you say over and over and over again. The particular one was the way that people in Indonesia greet one another. They don't say Andi Fofu, they say Namo Buddhaya. It's a wonderful, I was really impressed when I heard that. So two Buddhas will meet each other, Namo Buddhaya, they say that. Bring homage to the Buddha. And that's a lovely four-syllable phrase, Namo Buddhaya. Actually, you can say five syllables. Namo Buddhaya. And so you can do that when you are thinking a lot. Say Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya. And it sort of drops out the thoughts. But after a while, you get very bored doing that and tired. So, for the first minute, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya for 1 minute. And then you start to put the pauses between the syllables. Namo Buddhaya. Now, those pauses are important. Small pauses, first of all. In the third minute, even the pauses. Namo Buddhaya. Yeah? If the thought can't get in those spaces in the third minute, then it can be even more. And listen to the spaces between the sounds. If thoughts come up, close up, yes! So all you're doing there is a substitution method, which is very refined. Instead of thinking about all this worries you have, not more good time, focusing on that, until those old thoughts, they're losing momentum, pushing them out of the brain. And then, little by little, you put spaces between the Namo Buddhaya syllables. Extend those spaces, the thoughts come up, close the syllables down, put the spaces down again. And you expand the spaces and spaces and spaces until you don't need any more Namo Buddhaya. You have silence. So very skillful means. Take some practice and training, which is a nice way of getting some silence up. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya. Well, you have to listen in those spaces. Yeah. You still become aware of the silence. And that's why it's rumble, rumble, rumble. Once you're really aware of the silence, of course, you can't count it penetrated. This is too delightful. So that's the number of lines. The Ajahn Brahm, how is the return so as we started? Actually, started absolutely correct. Different from our imagination fantasies. It affects our thoughts as well, so what are the differences? The lyrics is sometimes are so scary. Your fantasies are not that scary if they are, if they fly away very quickly. At least in terms of quite powerful. And they're weird. You can't imagine things like lyrics. Because the colours are very deep. You can't imagine colours like that. So that's why when people come up and ask me about the lyrics, when they're really quiet, very, very beautiful, and colours like you've never ever seen before, then that's a short sign as limited. Very, very beautiful. Ajahn Brahm, how do you expand on complex images? How do we tell the difference between complex images and mental interference? It's in meditation. Just yesterday before the change in consciousness, I saw the image of a clear lake. Reflecting the surroundings, you must have seen that. And in a split second, the image disappeared, followed by the appearance of a faint green something, sparkles. See, first and bright sparkles several times. I wonder what the images were. That's to clarify. So, I want to understand what the images are. It's the way we experience the six senses, the mind. And, the reason why we don't normally see the images is because we are so focused on the five senses. We're mostly visual people. Most of our brain is taken up with processing sights, sound, physical feelings, taste and smells not so much. But those are the five senses which take up enormous space in our brain. Now when those five senses are subdued, so you're not looking around at stuff so much, it's nothing to look around at, you know, in this meditation center. Now when we're not listening to music, it's just old Ajahn Brahma's old jokes again, we've heard those before, so it's not really exciting the ears. You're sitting calmly, peacefully, so the body is not really excited. Only eating just morning and afternoon, or morning and lunchtime, so the smell and the taste is not really encouraged. So you're actually calming down the five senses. And as they calm down, hopefully you're meditating, getting some inspiration, some energy into your mind. That sixth sense has become stronger and more powerful. Until it comes to the point where your five senses and that sixth sense of mind are about the same strength. And that's where you start to see the minutes. The five senses haven't disappeared yet, but they're very subdued. And the mind is much stronger than usual. That's why it can pop up and you can see it. So when people have these limiters, this is the mind is starting to become strong. You can start to see some funny experiences. Complex limiters, little lights. Still you need to put more energy into the mind. Subdue, center straight, the other five senses. Don't talk too much, don't go looking around stuff. Don't sort of speak to one another, listen to conversations. You are calmed down by the senses. As they get more and more calm, mind gets brighter, you see more images. And especially when you meditate, you close your eyes, sight turns off, you're not paying any attention to sound, sound turns off, your body is still uncomfortable, body turns off, no smells, no tastes. The five senses are really getting subdued. You may still be able to feel a little bit of the body, but not much. Still hear some sound, but a long way away. And then when the big images come up, that is, the mind is so strong now, you can't beat it. Everything else is calmed down. And that's the big emphasis. So understanding it that way, you understand it's a natural phenomenon when the five senses are subdued and the sixth sense of mind is empowered. That's where you see the emphasis. It's the mind seeing itself in the mirror. That's what it looks like. So that's what happens. If your mind is complicated, then the emphasis is complicated. If the mind is stable, then the image is stable. So that's actually how it works. From this, I should say, that is similarly, Ajahn Chah's doing similarly, the still forest ball. I know that Paul White searches, he wasn't the best of marks. He got that as a title for one of the books, but what Ajahn Chah made when he told that similarly, he said that as a wandering monk, in the evening, you would always try and find a lake or a river because you needed water to bathe and water to actually to drink, you know, to fill your water bottle and maybe wash a few robes. So the wandering monks would always try and find a lake or a river somewhere. And after you've washed and filled your water bottle, then you put up your mosquito nets about 10, 20 meters away from the edge of the pool. You'd never put it on the edge of the pool because in the evening time, the animals would come to drink and to wash. And he says sometimes he would put his mosquito net up, sit inside, not meditate, just keep his eyes open, and watch the animals come out to play. It's like the nature channel we have these days, National Geographic. It's very popular to watch animals mess around, play with each other. It's very delightful. And this is where Ajahn Chah saw this before the TV cameras started. So you watch, but he said the animals would only come out to play when he was perfectly still. Because if the animals saw him move or make any noise, they know there was a human being there. And for most of the animals in the jungle, the human beings were the hunters. They were very dangerous. So even the tigers were more scared of humans than humans were scared of tigers. More tigers died because of humans, then humans die because of tigers. So even in Thailand, you know, we weren't afraid of tigers. They say tigers are not the problem for monks. Thai girls Many bad sides of being gobbled up by tigers. Tigers. Anyhow, here's another lesson. So anyway, there is the perfectly still. And Adam and Sarah could watch all these animals. They come out to sniff. They couldn't notice he was there, he was still. Then they come out to play. And he talked about watching these animals go out to play. And he said sometimes, some evenings, it was so still. But after all the animals came out, some amazing animals came out. It was so incredibly beautiful. And no one had ever told him that such incredible, beautiful animals ever existed. Because they were so shy. Most people didn't know how to sit that still. Those animals would always know that someone was watching. And Ajahn Chah, he could be still. And that's when the beautiful, gorgeous animals came out to play. Now the still forest ball. That's limitless and jhanas. These are very rare animals which come out to play in your mind, only when you're still. And this is a wonderful symbol which I thank Ajahn Chah for. Because sometimes I would be very still, I would imagine if I was Ajahn Chah and fly away. Imagine I had to be very still. And then the limitless would come out. If I moved, it would know I was watching. I was really peaceful and still. As if the limitless would come, is anyone there? Is anyone not watching? And I was so still they couldn't disturb me. They didn't know I was there. And then come out and play in my mind. It was incredible, amazing limitless. And when they had finished playing by my mind, things amazing animals would come out. Jhanas. Very rare, very beautiful. Only when I was perfectly still. If I moved, someone's there, it would come out. So that's a very beautiful sin because I could roll by the things, I can try still, don't push. And then these things would happen. Still possible. That's how deep meditation happens. If we open our eyes in the middle of a meditation session, can we continue to meditate or stop the session and say, right, of course you close your eyes again. But now if you realize for me it's not been getting anywhere, I need to go to the toilet, I need to do another form of letting go, get fine. So, just ask yourself, you know, can I still get deeper? So, carry on. How would I need a child from that to meditate? I don't know, I'm ready. Any guide on how to introduce, teach kids 5 years mindfulness and meditation. The same question, I've already gone through that one. Gave one suggestion anyway, so I'll go further. If one closes eyes to meditate, mind wanders so much, it's about to open one's eyes and look at something which is not moving for the beginning. You can try that in the beginnings. You know, just to calm yourself down. But as soon as you get reasonably beautiful, please close your eyes. Because the outside things are moving. And just a beginner meditating, this is normal that somebody keeps elevating the mouth as it might become still. What's that when I feel my breath heavier on one side? Of course, sometimes it happens, just swallow. Otherwise, you know, the other thing you can do? Sometimes I feel my breath heavier on one side. That must be the breath that needs to go to your side. Maybe you're bending over, maybe you're about to fall over, whatever. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Just as long as you know the breath is going in and going out, that's enough. How to relax before meditation? It is easy to say relax, but to do it is a task. Is there any method to start with? It's really weird, isn't it? Human beings don't know how to relax. That was one of the first things I learned as a student. Relax. And that's how they don't know how to relax. No wonder people really stressed enough. So now one, lean back. Let your shoulders droop. Let your hands just go all floppy and loose. Just, no worries, just imagine you're on a beach somewhere, on holidays. You're There's no mobile phone coverage. There's a waste of time checking your iPhone. No satellite coverage. No one can meet you. In their beautiful world, not too hot, not too cold. No appointments, nothing to do. Ah, relax. You know, sometimes people have to pay money in these things to look out relax. They go to a spa. I don't know why people go to a spa to relax. It costs a lot of money. You can relax much better here. So just imagine your body getting all loose. Nothing pulling it. Nothing squashing it. Just go to this natural, soft, open space. Just like lying in bed after a long day's meditation. Stretching out your legs. Snuggling into your cotton cushion, cotton pillow. Covering your teddy bear. Whatever you do in bed, relax. Relax means no effort in the body and peace. Not stretched, not holding anything, not squashing. Everything natural. You know that sometimes doctors have to inject people with anesthetic to make them relax. Really weird. Don't do those chemicals, just relax naturally. If you don't know how to relax, what's that? Well, this is. So we're always on the move, we forgot something really important in life. How to do nothing and relax. So, it's a hard thing to learn, but it's worth learning. If you haven't done anything else in life, except how to relax. That's what you learn from this retreat, make great strides. In between exams, as someone asked me today, relax. Stop worrying about stuff. That's the best way you prepare for the afternoon exam. Relax. Before you play a big tennis match, or came to sign or negotiate a big deal for your company. Relax. And then you usually perform to your best. So, little by little, you're mindful of your body. You can feel it tense. You know what is tense. You know when it lets go. That's called relaxation. When you do more mindfulness of the body, you soon experience the difference between relaxation and tension. Stillness, can you please demonstrate stillness? One minute and we'll be still. Dear Ajahn, I find that doing meditation with people is relatively easier to remain calm and peaceful due to a lack of stress, disturbances, and the hassles of daily life. Whilst coming out of retreat, the business happiness generated from the retreat will usually be lost for a short while before I become easily overtaken by greed, lust, hate, and delusion again. How can I maintain what I've learned during the retreat so that I won't be blessed on the path again? Don't leave! But it is true, when you go on retreat, you make lots of progress. When you go back home, carry on a little bit of meditation every day if you possibly can. And if you say you don't have any time, or perhaps you haven't got time to eat every day, so a rule of thumb, find out how many minutes every day you spend eating. And that's the number of minutes you should give to meditation. If you eat for half an hour, meditate for half an hour. Find the time for eating, so find the time for meditating, it's food for the heart. How to have an empty mind? For an empty mind is a happy mind. Just take it, and then walk away. Or maybe take a vacuum cleaner, put it in there, suck up. Wouldn't that be lovely that you did things like that? It's something physical. The other way to have an empty mind is the nature of the past, the future. So there's nothing else left. How do you empty out the trash can? You just realize it's not necessary. It's not important anymore, so that's where you can really go. Once you realize it's not important, you can delete the spam. You clear up all this mess in your computer so you've got more capacity, more storage. So this is your house, and you have an empty house. That's running things out. Maybe you come to Bodhidharma Maharshi, you come have a good like, hey, that's what I did, there's hardly anything there. The empty house. Give it away. That's like an emptiness, by keeping stuff away. We appreciate practical tips to prevent thoughts from dominating my meditation center. For morning sitting, I think about the day's work ahead. For evening sitting, I reflect on the day's work done, not done. The thoughts just keep coming back. So, make sure in your home you sit in a place with no windows, no clocks. You've got no idea at all whether it's morning or night or middle of the day. So that way you don't know where you are, what you're doing, so you don't know whether to think about the work coming up or the work is done, which means you get so confused you might become sick. So, what's the best way to prepare for the work ahead? Be quiet, be silent now. Meditation is the best preparation for lots of hard work next time. And as for the work which has been done, what's done is finished. Yay! Can you elaborate on how we measure ourselves on the peace altar? I find that even if I think I'm measuring me one, and they still don't have a good sitting. Be honest. No one is going to judge you for it. No one is going to sort of criticize you. But you're supposed to be honest. Keep your five precepts. I am a little peaceful. I am peaceful. I just come with this one. He says, what? Come on. It's one, okay? Who's that one? Obviously, that's not peaceful. So, you just give yourself, the more you look at the peaceometer, the more you understand what I'm pointing to, the more you get to know it, the more you see of it. You might not understand it. You understand how peaceful it is. It's not a competition. It's just an assistance, a help. So you know where you are and what you need to do. If you like looking in the car when you first turn on the engine and you find the gasometer, how much petrol you've got in the car, it's near to zero, what's the first thing you should do? Fill up! So where's the time driving from here to KO when you've got no petrol in the car? That's stupid. So where's the time trying to wash the breath when you run out of peace? You have no peace in the car. You break down on the road of meditation. So this is why we're not in peace in our car first of all. Peace often. And after a while we get to know. All we get to know is a very, very good indicator of where we should start to walk the breath. And also, we soon find out how to fill up the peace often. Really peaceful. Let it go. Be kind. You should feel that. So it's a very good method of meditation. Yeah, okay, I have to stop my mind from making plans. One thing, write down all the plans you have made on this retreat. Tomorrow, the next day, and then come back and tell me how many of those plans really worked. How many plans you actually used, and how many were a total waste of time. You will find 99% of them were a total waste of time. You didn't need to do that. That is an exercise of reinforcing the fact you don't need to make so many plans. You don't need to be so afraid just to let the future unfold. Understanding you can handle making decisions when they're needed, rather than making decisions that they're too defined. So you learn by noting down the plans and how useful they are, that the plans were a waste of time. And you can't waste your time so much, you're too busy for other things to do in life. Instead of busy making plans which never work out. So no plans. Just adapt. Life is an adventure. You never know what's going to happen next. The future is uncertain. So how can you plan for what usually never happens? Okay, last question. I'm getting tired. A few minutes after closing my eyes for meditation, I can feel my heartbeat. And I can feel that I'm gently inhaling the next day. But these feelings disappear once I try to observe more carefully. And other thoughts come in. Am I in a meditative state? not really, but you don't ever focus on the heartbeat, center on the breathing, put the breath in the center of the screen. At least it is just a big one I can't observe more carefully. If you don't try to observe more carefully, let the observation just grow naturally. Stop trying to do things in meditation, and then you will be very peaceful. One last question quickly, because it seems a month ago. Okay, I think I'll just read this last question. Thank you so much. Is there a remedy for this? Please advise. Thanks. There is no remedy for gratitude. I might even need the back side of this. The front side, I just leave that for lunch. Thank you. I picked it up with this one. Okay, what is this? Dear Shambhala, why does my head tilt upwards? It must tilt upwards because maybe it's just some gas coming out from your digestion and the gas that you like in the balloon and it's not like it's gas. Yes. Like a gas balloon, the difference is gas from your lungs. Gas from your lungs. Going into your head, if you have. I don't know. A few things are started. It's about how she gets the best. Why does my head so upwards and downwards slowly? Involuntary doing the meditation also happens at home. Two at times. Please clarify. Okay, this is easy question. That was just your body is balancing itself. Tilt backwards, tilt forward, just it's what it has to do to get energy going. So when that happens, just let it happen. It's good for you, it's good for us. So I think I've had enough. It's 20 past, time to go to bed. So there's lots of questions here. So these ones come. We've got one more, right? So who knows if any answers. Okay, so then, oh yeah, Sadhu. Sadhu. Okay, how wonderful, guys. See you in the morning.